Well, welcome back to this second Action RC podcast series. It's a new year. We are continuing with our summer series, reflecting on RC racing in Australia and beyond. A special nod to the history of our sport, as we have done, along with some more contemporary bits and pieces. Friends, I hope you've had a great Christmas and a new year, and you're ready for some RC fun this year. We have some pretty exciting episodes coming up over the next few weeks. I hope you'll stick with us. Today, for the second time in this podcast series, we're heading overseas. Our guest today grew up in the old country, learning to ply his trade on the grass tracks across the UK. Time behind the wheel of one of the most highly modified and fast Tamiya hotshots that I think you'll ever see. From there to world championship finals with both Team Associated in 1987, Schumacher in 1989, a host of European championship podiums, Reedy race podiums, and so on, before an eventual retirement. A life down under, and then just recently a return to the racetrack at the 2022 Vintage Bash. I'm delighted to be joined today by Rory Cole. Rory, thank you so much for joining me for a chat. I'm looking forward to spending some time with you.
Yeah, hi, Scott. It's good to be here, mate.
How long have you actually been in Australia? I don't think I caught up with that part of the story. So obviously you grew up racing in the UK and Europe and all those sorts of things, but you've been out here a little while. Is that right?
Yeah, I married an Australian that was Fish Creek. And so we migrated with the family, as many of us Brits did, back in 2005.
So you're almost a local. Almost
been in Australia quite a while now.
Well, we're happy to have you, and glad you're here. Let's maybe start this conversation at the end and work our way backwards, because I think I'm right in understanding that you've been away from RC for quite a few years now, but all of a sudden you're back. So what drew you back? How did you get to be back with a transmitter in your hand?
Yeah, that's a strange story. I finished up racing quite abruptly. I hadn't picked up a transmitter for 25 years. Wow. Since leaving the sport. And I was working in Australia, working away in a hotel back in April last year, back in 2020. Yep. And I got a random text from Aaron Defina, who'd been stalking me online and tracked me down to this hotel room and said, hey, we're going to try and put on a radio control car race. And with all the vintage stuff, and we'd be really delighted if you'd kind of come along and take part. So after kind of, probably about half an hour of umming and ahhing, I thought, yeah, why not? Let's go along. He promised I'd be able to kind of use his cars and, wouldn't have to do a lot other than turn up. So I kind of said, yes, I would. And then in the build-up to it, the hype, the chat on the Vintage Bash social media, I kind of got more and more into it. I was heading back to the UK, so I thought, why not? I'm just going to go and grab all my gear, and because it was still in the attic. At father's house. I grabbed an old favourite car of mine and the transmitter. Well, to be honest, I had to buy a new transmitter and some new electrics. I bought a transmitter, bought some equipment, bought some tools. So this thing that was meant to be just a quick away and ended up being the whole family came. So we had a couple of nights in a hotel and, so a few $1,000 later, as most RC stories do.
That is the way. So what was that car that you brought back from the UK?
It was my favorite car of all time, the Associated RC10. Okay. So it's like the kind of world's edition. So it was pretty much as I finished racing back in 93, I think, the end of the season.
Yep. So we're still in the era of the alloy chassis. We're not yet to the B2 kind of plastic molded tubs things.
We hadn't got to the B2. Finished. Well, yes. That's probably it was as that transition.
Yeah. Okay.
So I think everybody had transitioned to the B2 car, and I was still racing the alloy one for the last. I think in '94 I did like two or three events after I'd finished up in the national series because I'd qualified for the Euros.
Okay.
I think there was a Reedy race or something back in the UK, and I just did that because I'd already qualified.
So, I mean, I'm curious as to what it was like to, dig that old car out, get it running again, those first couple of laps, maybe when you eventually got to a track out, like what was that like after 25 years of kind of being away from it all?
It was amazingly familiar.
Yeah, okay.
It's strange. It's like you get into a zone when you're racing, and all racers will know. You get into a flow. You feel the car. And straight away it was I knew what I needed to do. I knew what the car needed to do.
Yeah.
And the difficulty was that the tracks have changed so much what we were doing, you know, back 25 years ago. The car could move into the new services and new tires, and but everybody was really, really helpful. I mean, I got given a load of new tires because I even brought the tires from 25 years ago. So imagine there were flat spots on the wheels, and it was a bit awkward in the first few laps, but it was it was a great feeling. And I think at the end of the day, I think every opportunity there was for free practice, I was up there charging the batteries, and I love these lipos because they don't That's run right. out after
it's after a different world hour. Isn't it it's a different world to where you and I different. Began I mean, I'm getting the impression that you really enjoyed the weekend, and you know, for those of our listeners who are not familiar with the race, this big vintage bash, kind of a reunion event in Australia in October 2022, you know, low emphasis on competition, high emphasis on sort of social and history and storytelling and just running and having a good time, and the racing kind of secondary. Is that how it was for you?
That's exactly how it was. It was a bunch of people with a common interest coming together and just sharing stories from, you know, wherever. And, you know, it wasn't competitive, although when you say that it wasn't competitive, racing is
of course
there's always those juices flowing, but it was more about the fun and getting the old equipment out, and it was a great weekend, and luckily we were okay, like luckily with the weather, that's always a good thing,
got away with it.
I
hear that there were a couple of replica cars, so you know, you might have been having a bit of a dice with a Masami Hirasaka RC10 or a Mike Dunn Losi. Are we having flashbacks, Rory? Were you kind of driving around going, what year is this again? Where am I?
Well, somebody thought it'd be funny to kind of, you know, drive Masami's car right up behind mine so I could kind of see it out the corner of my eye. And it looked pretty familiar at the time. So, there were some really good dices going back in the day with those cars and some of the replica cars that were out there. So, it did take me back. It's kind it's surprising because it, like, you know, they've taken 25 years out, but it felt like it hadn't gone away in a way. So it's even though I didn't know any of the people there, it's just that RC family. You know, people are just kind of engaged. They just, you know, enjoy what you're doing, and people, you know, are so welcoming and friendly. Yeah, it's a credit to the hobby.
Good. I've often used the phrase about big race meetings that they're like a gathering of the tribe. You know, there is that competitive thing, and there is that, you know, we want to find out who's the best, but there's also just a gathering of the tribe, and it's always a fun time to be at a racetrack with people who love the same kind of hobby together. So have we reunited a passion that will see you back playing around with a modern car, or is this sort of just a bit of a, you know, dabble with some vintage things and just a little bit of fun here and there?
It's an interesting question. To be honest, I've been offered Ray Mundy, and he's offered a kind of weekend to kind of go and have a play with the new associated cars, and I'd definitely like to have a go.
Yeah.
But it seems to me, just the way that the technology's evolved and the tracks have evolved, that we've moved more to a bumpy on-road version of the off-road class. Years ago, the tracks were a lot less traction. The cars moved around an awful lot more. The tracks deteriorated an awful lot more. So you had to adapt to the track conditions as the day progressed. And now with the with the oil tracks, the traction you're getting out of the tires, the the development in roll center and the car, the suspension, it's all about getting the traction down and getting over, like getting enough traction into the car to get over the massive, massive jumps. Yes. So it's kind of a different off-road scene to what it used to be. So
yeah, just this last weekend, going, my local club built a new track, a second track, which is purpose designed for running vintage cars. So they've got the new modern high grip, incredible racetrack that we use week in, week out. And then right next to it, a little vintage friendly track with, you know, loose loamy dirt that's going to change lap upon lap and, you know, little tiny jumps. And it, as the track was being built, I was standing there kind of going, this is exactly like what we would have started with our Tamiya Hotshot in 1985. Like it's incredible to see this little vintage track right next to this beautiful, incredible modern racetrack. Totally different, as you say.
Yeah. So, I mean, getting back to that question, yes, I think I'd like to have a go, definitely. My concern is being reasonably competitive. I wouldn't do myself justice because I've been away for so long and I haven't got the time to put into it to get good again. So.
Yeah. Yeah, coming back and moderating those expectations is probably a big challenge. That's certainly one I've been wrestling with myself. So let's go back in time and I want to drag you all the way back to the beginning, and because I want to talk, you know, through a chunk of your time, your career in the UK and Europe in the late 80s and into the 90s. And so I guess the origin question is, how did it begin for you? Where did your first RC car come from? How did racing get started? What's the origin story for Rory Cole back in the day?
I was always really close to my father and Stan. Although my family is still back in the UK, we kind of FaceTime regularly. We in contact regularly and try and visit as often as possible. But when I was growing up, my dad was very much into models, so he would do a lot of model ships, airplanes, and we went to a model show at a place called Eastnor Castle in just outside here in the Midlands in the UK. And that was the first time I ever saw any radio control car racing going on. I'd probably be about maybe 12 at the time, something like that. And I spent the afternoon sat by the side of the RC track watching people race toy cars.
Transfixed.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that led, I think, to my father kind of, you know, we kind of thought, okay, we'll buy a Tamiya Rough Rider. So my first ever car was a Tamiya Rough Rider that I think my dad bought because he was more interested in building it than running it. And so we built this car, and then we just ran around with a small kind of semi-detached house in the UK. So we had a tiny garden. Yep. We used to run laps around the garden, and I'd charge the battery, have a go, then pass it to my dad, he'd have a go. And then we kind of decided that we'd find a second car. So we bought a second-hand one as well. So he had a blue one and I had a red one, and we used to race each other around the garden.
Because you can't race with one car, right? It's got to be.
Exactly, yeah. You definitely need two and somebody to race against. So, so that led to kind of go into where can we go and race these things? Yeah, we need to find people to kind of. So we went to a club in Gloucester, which was just, a few miles away from where I was. I grew up in a town called Evesham in the UK. Yeah. And the interesting, the club down in Gloucester was, they used to meet once a month. They'd mow a section. It'd be like a local village fete somewhere. They'd mow a, like the grass really short, put some hoses or something down, and that would be the meeting. We went along to the first one, and I ended up winning the first race meeting I ever entered.
Soon
after that,
the talent was there right from the beginning.
So I picked up a little medal. It's still based on the back in the UK. Is probably the only one I've got. All the trophies are picked up and still kind of pinned to the thing back in the UK.
Beautiful.
And that's how it kind of all started. And from there, we went to more clubs. So there was a Worcester club and a Kidderminster club. So we used to kind of race probably Tuesday night, Thursday night, and go on the weekend eventually, various club events. And that progressed into from that Rough Rider era to I think the Frog was next. Yep. We got farther afield. I was doing okay with the local races, and we did a couple of trips to a circuit in a very famous circuit in the UK called the World's End Pub, and that was in Northampton.
Okay.
And it was just a lot of people used to get there, and there was some, you know, I think that's the first time I saw Jamie Booth.
Okay.
The Tamiya championships at that time were kind of run there, and they used to do the 540 class and the 380 class, and
yes,
we had a Frog with a 380 motor in it that used to go like really slow, and everybody had a really slow car, and we used to race each other around that World's End track, which was a source of great entertainment.
It is hard to believe we used to race 380 powered cars, isn't it?
Yeah,
grasshoppers and hornets and frogs and
especially when you look at the speed of them today and stuff.
I know, it's incredible.
Yeah, but it comes down to kind of accuracy, consistency of the, you know, and so it was good. It was competitive at the time. We used to get up to all kinds of tricks to try and get them to go faster, but they were pretty well regulated. So
yeah. So I've seen some photos of a very heavily modified Tamiya Hotshot that, you know, you're winning races with in, I guess we're talking sort of 86 into 87, which is when that car was around. There's not much standard left on the car that I've seen photos of. What's the story of that car? Where did that come from?
Yeah, so I guess that was in my early years. I kind of was doing well, got the sponsor model, a local model, Malvern Models, and at one of the events, it was a Tamiya event. I got eventually sponsored by Tamiya locally on like a little championship. So in the early years, in like 83, 84, 85, that's the kind of class I was really racing, was the Tamiya stuff.
Yep.
And so that's where the kind of hot shot developed. Mm. When we were racing that, it was, we were looking for something that was a bit more shorter wheelbase. So, and I'd already alluded to the fact my dad could never stop tinkering with the cars, and he was a very good model engineer. And he still is today. He's doing traction engines and all kinds of stuff today. But we talked about kind of shortening the wheelbase by about half an inch, I think, from the original kind of two gearboxes. So we cut the shaft in half. He built a frame. We shifted the battery weight a bit further forward to get a bit more balance and weight over the front end. Kind of pretty much used the Tamiya kind of gearboxes and transmission, and then just a completely kind of bespoke kind of frame that we solid chassis that we kind of developed.
I'm looking at the photos right now, and it's incredible. And I hadn't actually picked up on that shorter wheelbase, but you're right. For those who are listening, I'll try and drop a link into the show notes, or if you just Google Rory Cole Hotshot, it won't take you too long to track it down. The photos of this wonderful beast of a car from 86,
87. Yeah, we did some miles around the country with that car and that Tamiya championship, and it's a special car. I think once I moved on or finished racing, I think there's a couple of guys that have picked it up in the UK since, because we offloaded quite a bit of gear over the years, so that's out there with a loving owner, which is really nice to see.
We'll come back to that, because there's a few others of your cars floating around that I've seen as well. I guess I'm interested, you know, what's the vibe of the racing scene in the UK over that period? You know, from the outside, from Australia, we're reading, you know, Radio Race Car and Model Cars magazines, and we're seeing grass tracks. We're seeing the rise of Schumacher and PB as local manufacturers. What looks from the outside like just a super competitive UK national sort of a scene. How did it feel from the inside? What was it like as you started to kind of travel the country and, you know, and race further and further up the field?
Yeah, it was very busy at the time, and I guess there were a number of series. I mentioned the Tamiya series for their cars. There was also a radio race car national championship, which was a series of events, as well as the BRCA national events. And in the UK, it's the BRCA class races that qualify you for the international events. So in those early years of my racing, I think it was, from the club racing, we were focusing on the national, the Tamir kind of national championships, and racing those. I'd entered a national junior championship in, I think it was 84, and won that event as a 13-year-old.
Okay. Your first national championship.
Yeah.
Well, that, maybe that, unless that, the Tamir one, perhaps as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think Tamir was probably the first one, and then the junior one was the year after. And then I think it was about 86, I concentrated on the radio race car series. And won that series that year, and that was the year before the Worlds in Romsey. And what I didn't realise that although we kind of won that national championship, I hadn't actually qualified because I didn't do the BRCA series for the Worlds the following year. So there were the BRCA national events, there was a BRCA regional event. So it was a very hectic calendar at that time of year in the UK. It got to the end of 86. I thought, oh, bugger, we've kind of maybe made a bit of a balls up here because the world champion, we didn't even know about it really until kind of later that year that there was going to be this world championship in the UK and there was a chance to kind of race. And I'd gone to a meeting with the BRCA regional meeting, and it was at my local club at Worcester, and we put a track out, and all the BRCA racers from all over the country, some of the names like Jamie Booth and Stephen Haynes at the time.
Phil Davies or Glenn Pegler, those are some of the names I recall from.
Yeah, but Glenn Pegler, Peter. So all the top guys in the national series were coming to Worcester at that rate. And I kind of, because it was a local track, I was confident that did well. Actually borrowed a motor, and Jamie said, hey, because this was how friendly it was, Jamie said, hey, try this motor. So I put one of his motors in and beat him to TQ.
I was hoping that was the end of that story. I was so hoping that's what you were going to say.
And so that was he said, that's the last time I'm lending you a motor.
And there ended a budding friendship, just like that.
Well, I think it's been the start of a very long and good friendship. Yeah, so, good. That was that race, and it was at that point I think Jamie said, "Oh, you should have done these BRCA races this year and qualified for the Worlds." And it was like, oh, bugger. And that's kind of when we started asking questions. I was still quite young, but I think my dad started asking kind of some questions of what's the option of trying to get into the to the race like next year. So there was an option. We just had to kind of put in a request to the BRCA, and so we were fortunate in terms of getting into the World Championships as
a wild card sort of a
exactly. We were just a wild card entry, we had to wait until we pretty much had to wait until the end of all the practice and making sure that all the people that were coming hadn't actually arrived.
Yeah.
And then we got a spot. So, but before that, in that year, there was a warm-up event as most of the world championships, they have the warm-up races. And so earlier in the year, Romsey was kind of set, and we went down there with the, I think I was driving for PB at the time. We decided, but they brought out the PB car. I think the cap was roughly the same kind of time. Ended up being asked to kind of drive the PB car. There's a sponsorship deal, so we took that one down to Romsey, and I can't remember what two-wheel drive car I was racing at that point in time. It might have been a Scorpion, but it was more than likely a very early RC10 because I didn't use the Scorpion for too long. But I think it took the RC10 and the PPD down there, and but did really, really well at the at that event,
at the warm-up
event. Yeah. Yes. And that at that point, that's when I first got introduced to Mike Reedy. And at that event, he offered myself and Jamie Booth Works Associated drives and Reedy sponsorship. So that was a kind of big deal, I guess, at that point in time. He offered us that. And as a result of that, he kind of wanted to take us to the US and go and race in the US at one of the first Reedy races that he was trying to organize. So that was a big kind of turning point. That the result at that warm-up race for the in Romsey was massive kind of weekend.
Yeah, and to kind of, you know, join that factory team, having actually, if I'm understanding right, not even yet running the sort of British National Series, the BRCA National Series. That's incredible. Yeah. So was that Reedy race before the Worlds, or did you not travel until after the Worlds?
I'm thinking the Worlds would have been in around September.
Yeah, I think it's in that late summer.
And then the Reedy race in the US was in the January.
Okay.
But the offer of kind of sponsorship came at the warm-up race for the Worlds, and then we went from there. And then the story of the Worlds in Romsey was that we got in as a wild card. There was two of us that got in as wild cards. One was Kevin Moore.
Another big name in the history of racing in the UK.
That's right. So we had to sit out, you can imagine, for 5 days. I think it was, we were down there watching everybody do practice laps. And we didn't know that we were racing until the morning of the first round of qualifying.
Okay, so I just need to rewind here a moment, because there's a few things about that that make that even more incredible to me. Firstly, it's just the second Worlds. It's the second time the Worlds has run. You've sat and watched practice. You've not had any opportunity to do any practice on a track that, to my understanding, is quite unlike most tracks in the UK. It's a dirt track, not a grass track, which I think you've said you've been mainly running on. And then you go into qualifying and you make the Worlds A final. That, Rory, that's incredible to me. What was that like going into qualifying? You know, what was that first qualifier like as you stood on the driver's stand with no practice against the world's best?
There wasn't really any expectation from my point of view. So I was quite calm. In the qualifying side of it, but there wasn't, I didn't expect to kind of get into the final with no preparation. Yeah. You've got all these teams of people, you can imagine, the works teams, they've been there for 2 days or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
They know what tires they were using, they knew the setup. But in fairness, and it was always the same within the associated team, the car setup was shared. So the information that they guys had got from there, the setup. So I just put the same oils in the shop, we were running the same tires.
Yeah.
So we set the car up similar to what everybody had been running. And then it was just a matter of going out and delivering on the track. So, I guess I wasn't surprised. I kind of believed in myself, but, It was a good feeling. I just sneaked in there. I think I qualified 10th. I think it was the last qualifying round as well. So I think we got better and better as we got a few laps into the track. So
yeah. So at this point in Worlds racing, it's probably rocket round sort of qualifying, isn't it? Like single fastest to get in, rather than the more modern sort of point scoring system over multiple rounds.
Absolutely. I think there were five rounds of qualifying, and it was one round to count. Yeah. And luckily the track stayed, because it was a fairly unique track in the UK. Like you mentioned, it stayed fairly solid. It was bumpy, but it stayed people could still do times towards, like, I think, like the fourth round, which is, can be kind of unusual in those early races.
Yeah, that's right. So just to kind of talk through the results for a moment in that Tour Drive class, of course, that event famous for the sweep of the podium for Kyosho with the Ultima, led by 12th scale specialist Joel Johnson. Perhaps we might have a little bit more information about Joel in the next couple of episodes of this show. Katsunori Kondo in two and Chris Moore in three, sweeping the podium, as I said, with Kyosho. Most of the rest of the A final driving that RC10, Mike Christensen, Jamie Booth, and Kevin Moore, who you mentioned. So Kevin made the final as well as yourself on no practice. Defending world champ Jay Halsey, Masami was in there, yourself, Rory, and then Eustace Moore, the famous Eustace Moore from MIP, rounding out the 10 in that 1987 Tour Drive World Championship final. I mean, how did you kind of reflect on that at the end of that Tour Drive day? Were you pinching yourself to have gotten to race with these people that you've probably only seen in magazines? Or as you said, you were confident in your ability and it just felt like you belonged?
Yeah, I was a bit upset. I wanted to do better. I'm even more annoyed with myself because I've seen some of the videos and stuff that people have posted online. And, it's a couple of times I think I was running up in fourth and third places at one point. And when you see silly little mistakes on, it's just annoying.
Don't do that to yourself. Don't go back.
No. It was a great experience to get there for sure, and to race against those. There's some big names that didn't make that A final as well. I think Cliff Lett was in the B final.
So yeah, that's right.
I think I actually knocked him out when he kind of gave me the tire choice that he was using. So again, that was the last time they lent me anything.
Oops. Yes, unfortunate. Four drive obviously didn't go quite so well for you. Did you not run four wheel?
We didn't get the wild card in the four wheel.
Didn't get the spot. Right. That's why I haven't found your name.
We had to sit out the four wheel and watch.
Yeah. Okay. And so just while we're on that, four wheel drive, of course, went to Masami Hirasaka, the win, driving that long wheelbase prototype of the Schumacher Cat. His first of many world championships, an extraordinary kind of breakout performance, and also the first and I think only to date win for Schumacher in the off-road classes. Kondo second again with the Kyosho, Jamie Booth on the podium for the UK driving that Cat. And then just the names in that final, people like Cliff Lett, you mentioned, Joel Johnson again, Jay Halsey, Junichi Koma from Japan, Pete Stevens, Eric Soderquist, Mike Christensen. So just some extraordinary names from that period at that 1987 Worlds. Rory, you show up there, no practice, you put it in an A final, you've got this kind of factory deal that you've inked with Reedy. What happens for you from there, in the aftermath of that 1987 Worlds? Where do things go for you over those next couple of years?
It was just a lot of toy car racing at that point. I think I alluded earlier on in the conversation, we got to the point where we were racing on a Tuesday night, racing on a Wednesday night, racing on a Thursday night, and then race going away the weekend and racing. Mm. So it became this, life. And it was a traveling circus around the UK. There were a lot of events. I guess from that Worlds event, it snowballed into the more European Grand Prix in kind of later life as well. So I think the most exciting thing was that trip to the US. So that being invited to go and race in the US after that Worlds event was really quite special. And there's some real special memories. I typed in a story on social media about, I think I was 16 at the time, maybe turned 17, something like that. My parents weren't going. I was invited to kind of go across and compete. And again, my dad being my dad decided that we probably need a rear wheel driven cat. So we built another car, the prototype car with a motor that hung out the back of a four wheel drive cat. So that's something there's not many photographs of, but we took it because we thought it'd be good over the jumps and the types of track that they used in the US. So we were kind of working, we working with Schumacher at that point. So we'd moved from PB to Schumacher after that World Championship. But going across there, I was going to be chaperoned by the great Cecil Schumacher. He was coming over. Jamie was a couple of years older than I was, so he was the responsible kind of teenager. the other person who went with us was Phil Davis. So there was four of us going from the UK. So we've packed up our stuff. We've got on the airplane from the UK, flew over into Houston. And as you know, probably know, in the US, when you land, you have to clear customs. You have to get all your gear and go through customs and then recheck your bags to go on to your final destination. So obviously our final destination was Los Angeles. I remember flying in with Jamie. We got through, we got all our gear, went through, cleared customs okay after explaining what the dynamite sticks look like and batteries and all that good stuff. but we got through, and then there's another kind of baggage kind of check thing, and that you throw your suitcases on and it goes through an X-ray machine and off down to the airplane. And so Cecil has kind of gone through, threw all his bags on, thinking it was just a scanning machine. He's threw his hand luggage on there. So his hand luggage contained his tickets and his passport.
Oh, no.
And in those days, we didn't have any phones, so there were no electronic tickets. So it was all paper tickets. Yeah. So all of his stuff has gone on to the flight. So he's the only person that's got the ability to drive a car over there that can look after us. We get through. They can't get his bags because it's gone down into the baggage hall, so they've got to go and find it. We've got to go and get on the plane because we've got the connecting flight. So Jamie, myself, and Phil Davis ended up in Los Angeles Airport, basically all by ourselves with no transport to wherever we were going in the hotel, and waiting for him at like 10 o'clock at night in LAX, which is not a great place to be hanging around as a teenager with thousands of dollars of RC gear.
So no, probably not.
Luckily, Cecil turned up on the next flight, flight, and he managed to get us off to the hotel and get ready for the race week.
What a great start for the week.
Exactly, yeah. But there's lots of stories like that as we've travelled around various kind of countries and places. And people getting lost and, some really, really...
Adventures on the road. Stories.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I want to come back to sort of the Reedy race kind of experiences that you had, because there was a whole bunch of those, and I also want to pick up some Euro stuff. But just while we'll stick with the World Championships for a minute, because I want to then just kind of zip you forwards a couple of years to St Ives in Sydney, Australia, for the 1989 Worlds.
I guess
what I'm curious about that event, and I wasn't racing, but I was there trackside watching all week, an extraordinary event and a very typical Australian track, very flat, very hard, very slippery. Did it feel like you'd landed on the moon from what you were used to when you got off the plane and saw that racetrack in the showgrounds at St Ives under the trees? How'd you come to grips with the track itself? I guess, first of all, I'm interested in for that 89 Worlds.
Yeah, I remember kind of coming into St Ives, and it was fairly loose on the surface, and but we'd been kind of we had a few dirt tracks and stuff, so we'd got a little bit of experience. We weren't just racing on grass, I think, at that point. We were trying to kind of, because we knew we had to kind of compete, I think, on a global stage, and we knew that a lot of the American tracks were dirt, so, and a lot of the international tracks were dirt, so we weren't surprised with what we saw. It was just a matter of trying to get the car to kind of work on that slippery surface. I actually really enjoyed the layout of that track. I remember the iconic tree at the end of the straight through the first and the car breaker. So
I didn't get to race there until, I think it was 1993. So 4 years later, we had a state championship race there. I live in a different part of Australia, but we travelled down to race at St Ives, which really is, I think I've described it on this show, as something of a spiritual home of RC off-road in Australia. But the layout didn't change for all that time. So when we rocked up in 1993, it was still very much the world's layout from 1989. And yeah, it was a fun racetrack.
I just out of interest, I went like about 5 years ago. I was in Sydney for work, and I just took a drive up there, and yeah, there was, I mean, it was odd seeing it with nothing. I mean, it was just the track. It was like the skeleton of the track. There was no, so it felt very different, but
not all the world's infrastructure kind of around it. Yeah,
well, that's it. Yeah, and all the buzz of everybody being there, and because we all stayed down at the Checkers Motel just down the road, and the big thing about those events were it was the similar kind of people all coming together, like with that common interest.
Yes,
all, you all kind of met up at wherever the race was, and it was like a big carnival kind of atmosphere. It was something we'd all look forward to all year, and look forward to meeting up and kind of racing against the best people in the world. So.
Mm. That world's obviously famous for Masami Hirasaka taking the first clean sweep in the off-road categories, winning both two-wheel drive and four-wheel drive, and also for those extraordinary Yokomo tyres that seemed to catch everybody on the hop. You know, oversized compared to what everyone else was running, taking advantage of that loophole in the IFMA rules. How much of a thing as a competitor, Rory, at that event, how much of a big deal were those tyres, and was it possible to compete without them, or was it pretty much you didn't have those tyres, you weren't going to be fast enough?
Yeah, I was in a fairly unique position on that because I was racing associated in two-wheel drive and Schumacher in four-wheel drive. So the two-wheel drive, obviously, there was all the hype and there was all the noise around the tyre and the bigger wheels, and being part of the associated team, they got access to use those tires, and that's what we kind of used. I found out later that once we'd finished the two-wheel drive and I was in the four-wheel drive and making the final, I got offered the opportunity to use the other tire that was being used at the time, which was the low C X,
the X pattern. Yeah,
and the X pattern was actually more commonly used after that event than the Yokomo tyres. I think, as in all racing, there's a big element of psyching one another out. And actually, the preferred tyre was probably the low CX.
Interesting. Pattern. Okay, that's very interesting. Yeah, I mean, you're dead right in that psychology of racing, isn't it? Like, if you can put something on the track that everyone else is kind of going, whoa, what's that?
A lot of it's up there. A lot of it's in your head. You have to be kind of confident in your own ability. Not worry about what other people are doing. Just focus on getting your car to be as consistent as you can and just kind of knocking out lap after lap, fast and consistent.
Was that a strength for you over your career, or putting aside that kind of mental game of keeping too much attention on what other people are doing, just focusing on what you can control? It feels to me in this conversation like that might be something you're pretty good at.
I think in hindsight, looking back on my kind of RC racing career, I was always consistent. I was always no matter where we went, no matter what the track was, I was always fast and consistent. There'd be other people that would come in and they'd have a fantastic weekend and maybe even win the event or win the weekend, but they didn't have the consistency there and there out. So one of the things I'm really proud about is that pretty much up until the kind of last year that I raced, I went to every European finals event. And qualified in both classes for the A main at every single Euro. And again, that's consistency. Looking back in hindsight, I think I used to set my cars up with just a touch of understeer, which enabled the consistency, but it didn't give me the you're limited with understeer. So if you're racing with your car with understeer, you can't go faster than what you can slow down to get around the corner.
So perhaps compromising the ultimate pace in the interests of that consistency.
And I think in some events, and that comes back to the World Championships in St Ives, Jamie was saying, your car's understeering, your car's understeering, because it was just pushing on that last turn coming onto the straight.
Yep. Yep.
It was consistent. It was easy to drive,
yep.
but it just wasn't hooking in enough.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that's where, when you look at the today's technology and moving the weight forward, getting the weight on the front end, using the weight to kind of get the cars to steer and the, it's a lot more advanced, I think, today than what we probably were back in those days.
Yeah. So St Ives, four driver, you were in the final there driving that Procat. The final's made up predominantly of Yokomo and Schumacher cars. There's an AYK Pro Radiant in the hands of Mike Dunn in that final. And I think a Kyosho. Yes, Rick Howitt driving the Kyosho is on the podium behind Masami and Butch Clover. So lots of those big name manufacturers. That Schumacher Procat, of course, having been just re-released by Schumacher a few months ago. So there's a bunch of those popping up all over the socials at the moment, reminding us what a beautiful race car that was.
The thing about that car was you could just adjust everything, whereas cars up until that point, they weren't that adjustable. Everything was kind of, you know, it's plastic molded parts. So there was little adjustment. But when the cat came out, it was like, there was just ultimate kind of ways to lengthen it, shorten it, make those modifications to make it work. So
I talked with Robin Schumacher a couple of episodes ago about that notion of Schumacher being a very much an engineering driven sort of a firm, and that was evident in that car, and continues, you know, to be their thing today. But, you know, the mind of Cecil Schumacher must have been quite a wonderful thing way he saw things.
Because he came up with a ball diff, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that's the story.
Cecil kind of, it was the first car to kind of come up with the ball differential, and obviously, yeah.
So just before we duck away from the worlds, let me just quickly see if there's any thoughts from you on 1991 in Detroit, that crazy Loamy track that, you know, that was the kind of almost polar opposite to St Ives, or back home in Basildon in 93, both of those events, you're sort of there and thereabouts, without quite managing to stick the car into the final. But any kind of reflections on those two Worlds events?
I didn't do as well as what I thought I was going to do. Certainly in the States, in Detroit, I thought at that time in my racing career, I thought I was as good as what I would be in terms of consistency.
Certainly the evidence of results would suggest that's exactly right.
So I was pretty disappointed at those two meetings, but I remember the track in the US just being ridiculously bumpy. Like it was just to the point where it was random whether your car would actually go down like the straight. It was so difficult to get a consistent kind of line through that along the straight, just under the rostrum.
Did you have the opportunity to run one of those crazy prototype RC10s that the factory team were running at that event, or were there not quite enough to go around? I'm not sure how far they stretched with those cars.
We, as the team drivers at the time, we would have had access to, if there was any kind of kit or trick bits or whatever, they typically make about eight of them. So I think at that time, I think Jamie had moved on to Tamiya. And Craig had kind of grown up from the kid that used to be really fast that crashed all the time to somebody that actually put consistent laps together. We had some wonderful times kind of racing back at in the UK on that circuit, kind of growing up together. So
it's an extraordinary set of names, you know, Rory Cole, Craig Drescher, Jamie Booth, Kevin Moore, you know, some of those names we've talked about over that sort of from the, I guess, the mid to late 80s, 86, 87, through the next 10 years, really, that, you know, the four of you and others, people like William Mitchum and Ben Sternum and other people. But, you know, that extraordinary talent pool that was in the UK at the sharp end there, it must have been pretty fun racing with those guys, you know, almost week in, week out.
It's weird, Scott, you say that, but every event that you went to, like whether it was a small regional kind of event or whether it was a national event, you'd always have people pushing you a few seconds, there would always be competition. I mean, in the early days, there was guys at the club, that they'd be close. You go to the regional events and somebody would come out of the woodwork somewhere. Yeah. And another one was like another guy that was always there or thereabouts and occasionally ridiculously fast was a guy called Ellis Stafford.
Yes, there's a name, and another name that we've come to know well. Yeah.
And Ellis could be absolutely super quick and nobody could catch him. And then another week, he just didn't have that kind of consistency week in, week out. But yeah, there's a whole raft of kind of names that could kind of
talk to float around. So let's talk a little bit about Europe. If we kind of move away from the IFMAR side of things, I think they're the worlds that you got to over that time. So let's, and you mentioned earlier, and I've been through all the results from kind of 89, 90 onwards, and you do pop up not only in the final, but on or about the podium every time. So what's that kind of era of racing in the European championships like? You're racing in places like Belgium and Denmark and Germany, and, maybe I think there was one at home in England for you. Tell me a little bit about some of those European races.
The European races kind of, I guess, kicked off where we got to the point where we're being sponsored by the manufacturers and asked to kind of go and promote the sport pretty much. I think there was maybe one a month, something like that, in different countries in that kind of era. So we didn't get to go to all of them, but certainly there'll be a group of us head off in a car, typically in a convoy, over to a night on the continent. So we'd all drive through the night, get there on a Friday or whatever, do the race weekend, and then drive back on the kind of Monday. And again, we mentioned that carnival feel. There's a bunch of you all go in similar age, and it became. It was actually building the friend network, because again, going into Europe, you met kind of people, new faces, new friends, and racing in different tracks and different cultures and different environments. So some of the most dramatic races, I think, was back in France. The French really know how to put on a big show and event, and some of those races were quite special and interesting. We did one of the first overseas event Grand Prix that it was down in France. I'm struggling to remember the location of it was, but it was the south of France somewhere, Lyon, I think it was, all the way down. And the owner of Malvern Models at the time was a guy called Keith Chaplin, and we'd gone down. It was a 4-day event, 2 days, two-wheel drive, four-wheel drive. And, we've gone down. There's probably about 20 guys from the UK. I think we had a bus as well that year. So we'd all gone
down. What a great road trip that would have been.
It was fun. And you can imagine, we're packing all the stuff up after the race, and we'd done fairly well in France. I think, Jamie, maybe had won. I can't remember, it's that long ago, but the funny thing about it was after 4 days we got the port up, that we were packing all the stuff up to leave, and you got all the portaloos that everybody had been using, and we saw Keith duck into the portaloo before the before getting on the bus to come back and catch the ferry back to the UK. And one of the guys said, hey, did you see Keith go in there? And like, there's about six of us: Jamie, Stephen Haynes, Michael Bridges, all ran to this portaloo, and we rocked this portaloo to about 60 degrees kind of, and then ran and left it. And then there was this really, the door opened really sheepishly, and he came out as white as a ghost, thinking that he was going to be going over in a portaloo. It was one of the funniest things. It kind of, it always sticks in my mind as something that was hilarious at one of those meetings.
That is brilliant. I wonder what the statute of limitations is on Portaloo crimes. Yeah, whether you've just got those guys all in a bit of trouble there with that story. No, that's wonderful.
Yeah, well, we didn't actually push him over. I mean, he did think he was going with 4 days worth of sewerage in the thing. So
that may be the difference between the culture of the UK and the culture of Australia, because I can guarantee you in Australia that would have gone over on its side.
I think you're right as well. Yeah,
absolutely. So it's interesting kind of couple of things that you've said there, which I want to pick up on, because for those of us who live in other parts of the world, along, you know, Australia being about as far from Europe as you can get, we often speak of Europe as this kind of amorphous mass, but you've kind of just highlighted there that you travel to different parts of the continent, different countries. And so I guess I'm interested in, you know, whether you notice different, you know, differences in the RC scene in different, you know, are Belgian racetracks different to French racetracks, different to German racetracks? Is the, you know, from over here just go, oh, it's Europe, but of course it's not Europe. But, you know, there's all sorts of regional, cultural, language,
so many cultures,
all sorts of differences.
So many differences, yeah. I think raced in Belgium a lot, some of those were grass tracks in the early years. I think the Euros in Belgium was actually an eighth IC circuit.
Yep.
So it was really long and really flowing.
Yep.
And it was odd to race a 10th scale car on such a big, wide open track. Yeah. And we did a warm-up race there, and it was one of the Grand Prix we'd gone across, and there was a whole bunch of us gone across. And I remember... It's odd because even so many years on, I can still distinctly remember feelings after certain races. Mm. And one of the races there was, I was in, I think, heat 11, there were 12 heats, and had gone out in the first round and raced the car. And the car felt good. And I raced around, and it was this big sweeping eighth track. So it was a big lap, long lap. And I remember just kind of coming up to the last turn and the hooter going at 5 minutes and thinking, okay, just the last corner and then I'm over the line to finish it. That's it. That's a really good qualifying race. And then I've gone out to Marshall and I've watched the next heat, and Jamie was in the next heat. And so I'm kind of watching him go round and thinking, he's going well, he's going well. And then it's got to the 5 minute mark and he's basically just got over the line by 4 or 5 meters. Mm. And I'm sat there thinking to myself, geez, there's no way I can catch him. My race was as good as I think I could do. So for somebody to get that much, like, you know, another corner and a bit around, I'm thinking, geez, that's impressive. And then I checked the times and I was actually kind of 3/4 a lap up on everybody.
So you were right. So that feeling was right. It was a good run.
And it turned into a wonderful weekend because that was like, but that was one of those weekends where just everything worked. Everything was good. Everything felt good. Mm-hmm. And that was probably one of the easiest weekends racing I've kind of ever kind of come across. That didn't happen again. So
it is a special feeling, isn't it? When you're on and it just clicks and everything works and you almost feel like you can't do anything wrong.
But that's what you're striving for every time you go and race an RC car, is that feeling of the perfect lap. And I think that's back at the Vintage Bash a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
I was trying to get to that point where it felt right. It felt good. And it's an experience. It's a feeling that you can't really explain, I guess, to somebody that hasn't actually driven a car but when it's, you're just searching and searching for that perfection.
Yeah, and you're right too in that it happens for most of us. It happens so rarely that you never forget those moments. I could tell you a story right now of a single 5 minute race in Queensland in 1988, or whatever it was. I can tell you the time, the place, the car I was running, and that 5 minutes was as good a 5 minutes as I ever drove in 30 something years of messing with toy cars, and I don't think I'll ever forget that 5 minute run.
And that's special because that's something you can take away. And there's a few of those kind of moments, I guess, looking back, and some races that I've had with, so I remember distinctly on one of the Reedy races in the US. To be honest, in terms of radio controlled car racing, they are the toughest races when you're racing against like 24 of the best drivers in the world at any one point in time, and you're scoring points in every single race in every single class. That is, and you're still in different positions on the grid, and every race is a race. It's the toughest race to do well at, I reckon. And that, I remember the one race, the one year I was kind of in the States, and things were clicking. We'd got there. Typically what we'd do when we get to the States is we'd arrive the weekend before. The Tuesday night would be a club night at the local track that they were going to run the event at later in that day. So we'd get a club night's racing where we get our asses kicked by the Americans.
Every fast local, that's right.
They were there every day. Kinwall and stuff that would be, he'd be there. That's what he did. Every day of the week was like drive laps at that track, and there's Pavidis and all these guys that were just hammering laps out as well, and they're regular. So we go and get our asses kicked at the club meeting, and then try and kind of wind up to get quicker and quicker by the end of the week for the relay race. And we were like kids in a candy shop. So initially it was myself and Jamie. We get the opportunity to go and see Mike at the Associated. We'd see what motors and stuff they were working on, batteries, all the cells, all the kind of they go through thousands of cells kind of trying to put packs together that were ultimate packs, and then we get given the opportunity on the Wednesday or something to run through and go and get some spares in a box for the year. So it's January, so we go through the year, we grab some parts with the development team to see what pieces Gene and the team had kind of come up with in the development area, and pack some boxes together. That particular year we decided we'd go back from a graphite shell to an aluminium tub shell. So Craig and I decided we were going to build like new cars for the race the coming weekend. So we grabbed all the bits, went back to the hotel and built some new cars. And that weekend for me, again, it kind of clicked. I think I kind of raced probably the best kind of 12 races of my life in terms of that week. I think with Cliff in the two-wheel drive, we were pretty much neck and neck. And then we kind of moved into the four-wheel drive races. And there was one race there that I can really, really sticks in my mind, because I took the Schumacher cat, and the Schumacher team didn't come because we'd been a couple of times before and got smashed going to America racing against the Americans. But this time it did okay with two-wheel drive, very confident going into the four-wheel drive. And the four-wheel drive worked really well as well. So we were racing. I think I won the first one. And I got a race against Masami with the four-wheel drive. And he was off front, and we did about four or five laps. And it was neck and neck. It was one of those races that was like so, so close. And I remember jumping over this big jump, going down a bank and landing in front of him, but having to back off because I was going to kind of T-bone him. And it was just so, so close. And then on the back straight, we'd come up to lap one of his, I can't remember the guy's name, another Japanese guy with Team Yokomo at the time. And we've gone either side of him, of this car, and the guy's gone away from Masami's car because it was bright green. And clipped mine and sent mine over the barrier at the track, because we were literally kind of going past him at the same time trying to win the race. And the crowd just kind of booed. I mean, it was like three or four people deep all the way around. And it was just such an electric atmosphere. It was it's probably the one thing one race that really kind of stands out, that it was so close, it could have gone either way. And from that point on, I'd kind of I'd lost them at points then, I think, and Masami had won every four-wheel drive, and I think he climbed in up to third, and I finished second, and Cliff got the win overall. So, but it was, it was a great weekend. The only regret I've got is that my dad really wasn't there to kind of see that race.
Because that would have been pretty cool.
It was just such a, such a kind of strong weekend, and we'd done everything together in terms of my racing career. It was always with my father.
You know, looking through the records and the, and again, I'll try and put a link into the show notes for people, but if you go searching on the readyrace.com website, you can actually find, so it's for our listeners, you can find, scanned magazine articles for lots of Ready Races from sort of 1986, 87, when it started to kick off right through. And so I've been well down the rabbit hole, as we've prepared for this conversation. And it, what strikes me, Rory, is, what an extraordinary set of experiences and opportunities you must have had, because some of those Ready Races, that I see your name in, not just in the US, but in Japan, in the UK, sort of all over, in France, all over the place. You really did get to travel around the world with that set of those series of Ready Races and, being part of that factory team. What an extraordinary experience and a time it must have been.
Very, very fortunate. Extremely, extremely, fortunate to be in the right place at the right time to pick up the, the opportunities and to be, given that opportunity by, the Associated, Yokomo, Jumaka, all the sponsors were 100% behind us. I must admit, I did growing up thinking that everybody did it though.
As an Australian, I can tell you that everyone did not do it.
It's like, we're meeting the same people in the same, different parts of the country, so everybody must be doing it. But no, looking back now, and the other thing that I need to kind of make a mention of is that I've since kind of got involved in community sport outside of radio controlled car racing.
Yep.
And what I didn't appreciate until I was older was the effort that every club was in. So you've got a team of that, whatever the club committee is, the president, the secretary, the helpers, the guys that do the tracks. Everybody's got to put out a word of thanks into those guys, because the effort that they put in is unbelievable. I've done it with the soccer club in the last few years. I know the hours, the time that gets put in. So to put those events on, like we were talking about, takes an awful lot of work. And as an RC racer, a kid, teenager, I really didn't appreciate the efforts those people put in. So I really want to kind of emphasize
just on that.
All that work that people put in, because
So two things out of that. Firstly, you just called it soccer, so you really must be Australian. But secondly, I think you're absolutely right. And it's a couple of episodes ago, we actually set aside an episode on this podcast to talk with a club committee about, in Australia, as, I think is the case in the UK, a lot of RC is club-based as opposed to, small business, hobby shop sort of stuff that seems to happen in the US. But so we did set aside an episode to go deeply inside, what makes a club tick. And, these stories that we heard of, the culture of the group, the spirit of volunteerism, the commitment to hard work, all of these sorts of things that, and this is a modern contemporary club, but it's the same story, isn't it, from the days when you were racing. So, I just want to join you in honouring all of those who put their hands to the wheel to, build racetracks, to organise events, to cook the burgers, whatever it might be that makes the sport tick.
Absolutely. We couldn't do it without them. And, like I say, as a kid, as an RC car racer, I just didn't appreciate it, but I certainly appreciate it now.
Rory, I'm really conscious of the time, and we've kind of burned through a bunch of time. We've talked about heaps of things, and as we go, I keep thinking of another 100 questions I'd like to ask you, but we'll kind of honour the time. So I guess as we draw this conversation to a close, we've talked a little bit about some of the people you raced with. We've talked about some of those teams, Team Associated, in Yokomo for the most part, Schumacher for a period of time, PB, Tamiya. Are there other people, I guess just an opportunity for a shout out to, other people that along the way that kind of helped your RC career? Your dad obviously was super important. were there other people along the way that, you know, that are worth kind of a shout out to?
Another guy called Nick Marsden. So he was fundamental in Nosram. So Nick, I mentioned at the very start of the program, we went to a club called in Gloucester, and Nick ended up living in, he was living in Evesham. So he lived in the same town as I grew up in. So I spent a lot of time as a teenager with Nick, and he taught me a lot about life as well as kind of toy cars. And we've kept that kind of relationship going today. So I ended up living in the US for a while and ended up living 2-3 miles from Nick because Nick's also living in the US.
A small world
as well. So it's a really small world.
There'd be loads along the way.
Too many to mention. But to everybody I ever raced against, thank you. It was a great kind of a great upbringing. It was, I'd also say to anybody that wants to get involved in radio control car racing, it's a wonderful sport for learning engineering. Just the kind of the suspension, the geometry, electrics, electronics. It's such a good platform for teenagers to kind of go into life with some life skills about real things rather than virtual software stuff. So if you've got an interest in kind of engineering for a career, that's what I did. That's when I stopped. I stopped because I was really interested in what I was doing at work, and work was just kind of became the next kind of hobby for a few years. So
was that a hard decision, or was it just it was the right thing to do at the right time, and interest had kind of moved on?
Yeah, I think I was getting frustrated because at the time batteries were so so important. Like when you're racing at the top level, we touched on Basildon. Basildon, I didn't make the final because my car went flat.
Okay.
And at that point, I was just, and a couple of races in the UK BRCA series, my car kind of went flat at the end, and other people's cars were going faster. Yeah. And I knew it wasn't me. I knew personally, I thought it was the equipment. And at that point, I'm going, I've had enough. And I turned around. I remember the conversation with my dad, and my dad said, you're going to have to do something. And I was like, no, I'm done. This is the last race meeting I'm doing, and I'm stopping next year. So the last race, BRCA race I did was in Wales. And it was at that meeting. We had a bit of a, because we did have some heated conversations and some very quiet trips home occasionally.
I've traveled with my dad over many years in a mirror image of yours. And I know exactly what you're talking about. There are some long, slow, quiet.
Exactly. Yeah. But we weren't quite as bad as some others that we could mention. No. We won't go into, but it was one of those conversations where it was like, no, I'm done. I was interested in my work. My work was kind of taking off. I was traveling the world with work as well, and getting the opportunity to move around the world with the career I decided to take. So it was just time to hang up the transmitter. My father actually carried on. He worked with the BRCA and was volunteering, scrutineering in the UK for 2 or 3 years after I'd retired. So he's still involved. But the biggest thing I missed was that just the people. I mean, it was like a big family. It still is a big family. We've got an old boys of RC chat group that there's a bunch of us on it from the UK. And so the rumor about the Ashes and trying to get a vintage bash kind of team race kind of thing, like I'll be certainly kind of throwing it out there and offering the guys a place to stay if ever they wanted to come across. And
all right, so there is just that little rumor going around about an attempt to get a few of the kinds of names that we've been talking about, people like Jamie Booth or Craig Drescher, out for the vintage bash in Australia next October. And maybe a bit of an Ashes Australia v UK series. That would be super fun.
Bit of a team race, absolutely. Some of the best things I think I've done is we've had a couple of team races in the past, and they've been brilliant. The other races that I haven't seen in Australia and I haven't heard of in a while, but with Schumacher, we did a number of 24-hour races.
Yeah.
And I remember one race in France where it was with Phil Booth, who built the car, myself, Phil Davis, and there was one other Tim, who used to be Schumacher.
Yes, his name's escaped me momentarily as well. Mm. I know who you mean. Yeah.
And every time they drove the car, they broke it. So I ended up driving for 13 hours in a 24-hour stint. And I will honestly say that I had repetitive strain injury in my phone. I couldn't move. I was crippled at the end of it. Yeah. My eyes were completely red. And, yeah, so there's probably a health warning on that one. Don't race
it. It would be super fun. I did race in a two-hour two-hour race at my local club, an end-of-season, which has become a traditional end-of-season race. Just before Christmas. And it was great fun, you know, working with three other guys, team of four, you know, one car. And it was only 2 hours, but, you know, and I've done a couple of 6-hour races here in Australia, but a 24-hour race.
Yeah.
That would be pretty fun.
They were some of the, more kind of like, they were some good events. And again, we used to kind of travel into Europe a couple of times into France. And I think it was one every year in the UK for, one of the Midlands clubs used to put it on, but it was more for charity than anything else.
I'm having a vague recollection of a 24-hour race which involved everyone running the same car and the teams being presented with the kit as the who to win, and the 24 hours included building. So it might have been sponsored by a Tamiya or Kyosho or someone like that.
Yeah, that's a new one. I've not heard that one. That would be entertaining.
It's a very vague memory somewhere at the back of my mind that I've heard of a race like that somewhere over the years. Anyway, maybe that's an idea for Vintage Bash 3.0. We can. Rory, it's been an absolute delight to chat. There are a million other questions, but I've taken up enough of your time. So, you know, for a man who got started on those grass tracks with that Tamiya Rough Rider way back in the day, you know, through pretty much 40 years later, you know, putting one of your own vintage cars back on the track here in Australia for the Vintage Bash. Thank you for talking us through the story, through some of those Worlds and European and Reedy races, an extraordinary career you had, and, you know, a scholar and a gentleman for taking the time to chat with us. I look forward to meeting you in person one day, perhaps at the Vintage Bash next year, where maybe we'll get to go head-to-head in the few moments before you disappear down the track and leave me in your dust. But thank you heaps for chatting with me today.
Thanks, Scott. I really appreciate the opportunity. It's been good chatting to you.
It's been a delight. And we'll who knows if we might think up a few more stories and have another chat down the track. Folks, thanks for joining us for this episode. I said at the beginning there's some pretty exciting guests coming up over the next few. I won't name names, but I will say people from, again, beyond the shores of Australia, kind of in the pipeline, and I'm looking forward to those chats. So wherever you're listening to this, if you hit that subscribe button and join us, would love you to share this podcast around the place. We're really just getting started and trying to kind of spread our wings a little beyond Australia. That's it for today, Rory. Thanks again. Thanks heaps for joining us, and to all those who are listening, thank you for hanging in there with us. Have a great day.